GTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Jack and Drea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911. Now reopened for in-store shopping on Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday from 11 till 5, Saturdays from 10 to 4. Don't forget your mask. And you can still shop online at jackandrea.com. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We'll be spending the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show talking about a book which certainly has at its heart a most provocative idea that the history of Western civilization is actually in some respects based on or laced with psychedelic experiences dating all the way back to the ancient world. That, for instance, there were many ancient Greeks who experienced very powerful encounters with psychedelic substances that transformed the way they saw themselves and the world. And this book also explores the possibility that such experiences were actually a part of the ancient Christian church, and that some of what we might take for granted if we are part of that tradition actually have their roots in some of these practices that for centuries have been almost completely shrouded. That is the contention of Brian Murarescu, the author of The Immortality Key, The Secret History of the Religion with No Name. Brian Murarescu is actually a lawyer who has been practicing law internationally for more than 15 years. But as someone with degrees in Greek, Latin, and Sanskrit, he has long had a burning interest in the ancient world and has come to be quite taken with this largely unknown facet of the ancient world. And this is what he explores in his book called The Immortality Key, published by St. Martin Press. Brian Murarescu, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much. I feel very welcome. That was great. Thank you.
This is a really intriguing book. We should mention that the foreword is by one Graham Hancock, who I interviewed on the morning show a few years back. And many people will know the name of Graham Hancock for some of what he has proposed as sort of alternate ideas about where we all come from and so on. Some of his ideas are merely provocative. Some would say outrageous. It kind of depends on your own perspective. Since his name is proudly adorned on the cover of your book and he has written the foreword, I wonder if you could just say a quick word about your connection with him and if, in a sense, the two of you see the world very much in the same way.
Sure. So Graham has been a great and kind friend. To write the foreword. It was one of his books, Supernatural, and Graham's had a long, storied career, but the book that really caught me was Supernatural, I think in 2006. And it's there that he explores the potential use of psychedelic drugs in deep prehistory. And in that effort, he's really just following the scholarship of David Lewis Williams from the University of Witwatersrand in South Africa. And when I started reading Graham's book, it really keyed me into this theory, which is not mine, but this controversial theory from 1978 that the ancient Greeks were also using drugs to find God, and the even more provocative question that perhaps the earliest Christians had inherited the same secret tradition. And so by reading Supernatural, I realized there was a much, much longer story here, not just a couple thousand years old, but perhaps tens of thousands of years old. And I myself am a psychedelic virgin. Graham Hancock very much is not, and he proudly talks about that. So I felt it appropriate for someone who had actually had these experiences to introduce the book for those and provide a little background for folks like me who had never experienced psychedelic drugs. It was very important for me that I address this mystery as objectively as possible.
So in other words, for whatever personal sense of intrigue you might have or interest in psychedelics, you have made a very conscious decision to not actually partake of them in order to, in a sense, create more of a sense of objectivity from which to write about it.
Yeah, as much as possible. And also with the elephant in the room that these things are illegal in this country and most of the world, we are very quickly moving to legalization. And part of the reason I write this book is to help educate people, not just about the ancient past, but what's happening today. You know, the FDA is going to get involved in these clinical studies that are happening right now at places like Johns Hopkins University and NYU and UCLA, studying psilocybin for end-of-life distress, for example, which is fascinating. And the common feeling is that within the next 5 years, you will see psilocybin approved for some clinical conditions, whether it's end-of-life distress or anxiety, depression, addiction. This is all going to happen in the relatively near-term future. You wouldn't just take the drug and walk home with it. It would probably be under the care of a trained personnel in a regulated licensed facility, which I think is fantastic. What I'm thinking of is what happens 10 years from now. Do these medicines become available in one of these regulated centers for the betterment of otherwise healthy people, whatever that means, for the betterment of well people? Is it possible we may all have the opportunity just once in our lives, and that's what I advocate, only once under these strictly controlled conditions, to enter into and experience the thing that these volunteers are saying is one of the most meaningful experiences of their lives? That's what really hooked me on this mystery, because it's the same kind of thing you hear in the ancient testimony.
Let's talk for just a moment about this book that came out in 1978. And you're very careful in your book, and have been careful already in this interview, to say that this is not a completely untold story. This book that came out in 1978, The Road to Eleusis by Albert Hoffman, Gordon Wasson, and Carl Ruck, was a case of absolutely terrible timing. That in so many ways the world was just not ready for the kind of things that they were saying. And I think that's really intriguing, whatever one might think about this, however one might be either open or resistant to much of what you talk about in this book. It's really intriguing to kind of wrestle with the question of what does one do with provocative thoughts, provocative ideas? Does one wait for the right time to spring these on the world? What is the best way to frame them? What is the best way to make them concrete and well-established versus just fictional flights of fancy? I felt like as I read your book, a lot of those kind of questions really came to mind. And I suppose those are questions that you've had to wrestle with in shaping your book.
Yeah, and I'm very honest about that. I've been wrestling with those questions for the past 12 years. It's taken me 12 full years to put this together. If I look back even further, I mean, I first read that 1978 book, The Road to Eleusis, when I was an undergrad at Brown University. I was actually recruited to Brown to study Latin, Greek, and Sanskrit. And, of course, I came across this book, The Road to Eleusis. which is pretty out there. And I wanted to talk to my professors about it. It wasn't so scandalous in the late 90s, early 2000s. The problem was there were not a lot of scholars writing about the ancient use of drugs. And so I kind of had to just leave it there for a while. It wasn't until 2007 when I started reading those initial studies out of Hopkins about these psilocybin volunteers having these deeply mystical experiences, these life-transforming experiences, that I thought about the book again. Because in the very first line of this article that I read in The Economist, of all places, it was called The God Pill, a very short article about the psilocybin experiments. The very first line mentions Gordon Watson, the same Gordon Watson who co-authored that book, The Road to Eleusis, with Albert Hoffman, who, as we know, discovered LSD in 1938, and this guy, Carl Ruck, Yale, Harvard-educated, who at the time was the chair of the classics department at Boston University. Now, today, he's the only surviving member of that trio. He's 85 years old and still teaching. And for years and years and years, I was wondering, is it just a case of the wrong book at the wrong time, at the height of the war on drugs, or was there something else I could contribute to his investigation? And I really locked in on the science. So the psychopharmacology that I'm talking about from Hopkins and NYU, it's one part of the puzzle. What really broke it open for me was this relatively new discipline, archaeochemistry. And I spent a lot of time talking to Andrew Koh at MIT. He's one of the premier archaeochemists in the world. His job is to go out into the field and test these ancient containers for organic residue. Lo and behold, you do find all kinds of plants and herbs and psychoactive material that has miraculously been preserved inside this ancient material. It's just fascinating, but it's all relatively new, relatively underfunded, but he's found some incredible things.
We're speaking with Brian C. Murarescu about his new book called The Immortality Key, The Secret History of the Religion with No Name. And the religion with no name to which the title refers is the utilization of psychedelic substances such as perhaps psilocybin, the active compound in what's sometimes known as magic mushrooms, and achieving spiritual experiences that can be quite powerful and long-lasting. And one of the things that Brian Murarescu explores in his book is the way in which this seems to have been an important facet of life in ancient Greece. Brian Murarescu, tell us more about what I think at one point you referred to as the spiritual capital of ancient Greece, Eleusis, and where this was exactly and what this was exactly as far as we can tell.
Right. So that 1978 book, The Road to Eleusis, talks about Eleusis, which I refer to as the spiritual capital of the ancient world. So today it's this small town about 13 miles northwest of Athens in Greece. It's called Eleusina today. And ironically enough, it's been nominated as the European Capital of Culture for next year, which kind of blew my mind as I was writing this book. It's about to come back on the map after all these centuries. It survives, as far as we can tell, from about 1500 BC to the 4th century AD, when it's obliterated under the Christianized Roman Empire. So we're talking close to 2,000 years, i.e. as long as Christianity itself has been around today. The thing is, it seemed to have attracted the best and brightest of both Athens and Rome. Even after the Greeks decline in influence, the Romans keep it going. So we can talk about the guiding lights of Western civilization making this pilgrimage from Athens to Eleusis to drink this potion, enter Demeter's temple, have a vision that, in their words, makes them immortal or divine or conquers their fear of death. It included folks like Plato, Pindar, Sophocles, Cicero, even Marcus Aurelius, the great philosopher, centuries later. Cicero, as a matter of fact, said that Eleusis was the most exceptional and divine thing that Athens ever produced. Now, think about that for a second. Not democracy, not the arts and sciences, not philosophy, not the concept of a university, but Eleusis was the thing that held civilization together. It's really remarkable stuff. But here's the other thing. It was all secret, which is why Houston Smith, one of the greatest religious scholars of the 20th century, referred to this as the best kept secret in history. That's not fancy marketing. This is Houston Smith, who himself had a very profound psychedelic experience in 1962 as part of this Harvard psilocybin project. He called it the greatest cosmic homecoming I've ever experienced. So there were serious, serious scholars looking at this stuff. And I do think part of the controversy is just the wrong book at the wrong time. And now this science has developed to really look into some of these chalices and what was happening at Eleusis.
Can you explain why this should have been, in your words, shrouded in secrecy from the beginning? I mean, why should it have been such a secret thing? I mean, typically things are kept shrouded in secrecy for some kind of reason. It might be a good reason, it might be a bad reason, but there's typically a reason. What would you surmise is the reason for all of the secrecy surrounding this? Not secrecy now, secrecy then, when this was being done.
Yeah, I think about this a lot, and I think I'm gonna burst a secret here, which is a bit of a sacrilege. You know, the penalty for revealing what you saw at Eleusis, and universally, the ancient testimony, what little clues we have, do talk about seeing something. This vision, Plato calls it a blessed sight and vision, the holiest of mysteries, he says. I think part of it just has to do with the sacred nature of these rites. And when you think about traditional societies and different shamanic initiations that would have preceded the ancient Greek civilization, you know, the concept of a secret society wasn't unique to the Greeks. And as a matter of fact, the Greeks probably picked up these mysteries, not just Eleusis, but their other mysteries, these initiation traditions, from the surrounding area, from North Africa and the Near East and parts even further east. So I think part of the trial is that you don't know what's going to happen. And I think that was the whole secret, is that you prepare, you look forward to this. You go through emotional and psychological preparation, we think, for many months. It could have been even more than a year before you went to Eleusis. And you wouldn't even be initiated. You wouldn't have the vision the first time. It would only be on your second visit to Eleusis that you would become a full initiate, what they called an epoptes, which is kind of like someone who's seen it all. It was a long, drawn-out process where you're essentially preparing for a vision that Carl Ruck says made all previous seeing seem like blindness. Now, if you know what's going to happen, it's not really as special. When you go into one of these experiences, the modern volunteers talk about dying. And they actually use that word, that under psilocybin, they experience things that they call a foreshadowing of their own death, that it's acutely and terrifyingly real. It seems like a part of you is actually dying, but what's happening is that they seem to be having this experience of rebirth into a larger or more profound aspect of the self. And again, if you know what's going to happen and everything is going to be fine, I think it lacks the same power, hence the secrecy.
How is it that we know the relatively little that we do know about the rites at Eleusis? Despite this thick veil of secrecy, what survives that at least give us clues?
To be honest, not much. Again, talking about it was a sacrilege, so nobody really did. There were no books and records. It was consciously preserved, I call it, as like a prehistoric throwback. You know, we think of ancient Greece, the civilization that birthed all this literature, and yet they write nothing down about Eleusis. It was preserved as an oral tradition. We also think about ancient Greece as the wine country, the same wine country it is today, like its neighbors in that part of the eastern Mediterranean. The potion that was drunk was a barley-based potion, like a beer. And so one of the clues we do have is this hymn to Demeter that survives from the 7th century B.C. It's this 496-line poem that's kind of like a foundation myth for what was happening there. You know, Demeter is out looking for her daughter Persephone, who's been abducted into the underworld. And in her long search over 9 days and nights, she lands at Eleusis. And the king and queen there take care of her by offering her a glass of wine. And she says, no, thank you. I would like the kukion. And this is where we get this idea of the magical potion. And she lists out the ingredients as barley, water, and mint. And I talked to a beer scientist in Munich, Germany about this, actually, Martin Darnkow. And as we got to talking, without overstating the case, it kind of reads like a rudimentary recipe for beer, if you think about it. Clearly there was something more than the alcoholic content of this drink that fueled the mysteries. And so I went on this long prehistoric hunt for beer and actually managed to find traces of it going back 12,000 years all the way to Göbekli Tepe. And I questioned whether or not a sacrament like that really could have survived for 10,000 years, making its way from prehistory all the way to the ancient Greeks.
Explain what happened to Eleusis right around the year 392.
Right. So as I said, it's under the Christianized Roman Empire. Christianity is born in the first century A.D., and it's illegal. It's an illegal cult, like the Dionysian mysteries, for example, these ancient Greek pagan mysteries of Dionysus. Christianity is illegal, and it doesn't become legal, or at least decriminalized under the eyes of the law, until Constantine, right, in the early 4th century. And then from there, as more emperors come along, you finally have Theodosius towards the end of the 4th century AD, who makes Christianity the official religion of the empire. And at that point, these pagan religions have to go. Now, the church fathers had been railing against them for a couple centuries at that point already, from the 2nd to the 4th century. But by the end of the 4th century, these pagan rites really do disappear. Now, I don't think you can blame Christianity for all of it. But we have so little that survived from the ancient world in general. But at that time, they basically disappear and they fall off the map. And there's a prophecy that's left to us from the 4th century AD in the Greek literature about this Roman initiate Phaethextatus who had gone to Eleusis. And he says, hold on a second. If you kill the mysteries, you're going to kill us. A provocative statement. He says that the mysteries, Eleusis in particular, were the one thing that held the human race together. And without it, life would become unlivable, abiotos. And off it goes, and it's replaced by Christianity.
So one of the most intriguing facets of your book, even beyond this exploration of what happened at Eleusis, and are there other examples of a similar kind of use of psychedelics through our history, is you also explore what is an interesting question, which is, are we Greek or are we Christian? Are we a people of reason or are we a people of faith? At one point, you call this the old identity crisis. You liken it at one point to a sort of schizophrenia. At one point, you talk about two famous paintings, The School of Athens and The Last Supper, and kind of pose it as sort of a choice between two possibilities. I wonder what prompts you to be drawn to this kind of question. And is it a question that sort of suggests that we have to make a choice between one or the other? I mean, like I, for instance, I'm a Christian, but I think of myself as a very reasonable person who appreciates and understands science and so on. I don't feel like I have to be one or the other. Is there some profound way in which you believe that we must be one or the other?
That's a great question. You're the first person to ask me that. This is exciting for me to talk about. In the very beginning of the book, I show you two paintings, and your listeners can almost immediately call them to their minds. One is the School of Athens. You have Plato and Aristotle there on the steps, right, surrounded by this cross-section of Greek luminaries, these representatives of logic and rationality and reason. And then I also show you the Last Supper by Da Vinci, and we all know what that looks like, Jesus and his apostles seated around the table at the Last Supper. And I pose those two paintings, and I show them to you to ask the question, there's this belief that the Greeks, the ancient Greeks, drafted the very blueprint of Western civilization, all those things I mentioned. They gave us the democracy and arts and sciences and philosophy. But then Christianity comes along and somehow saves our soul, that we have this schizophrenia between the reason that preceded Christianity And then this deep abiding faith and revelation and salvation that came with Christianity, this one-time intervention by Jesus into human history. But it begs the question, the Greeks found salvation at Eleusis. There's no doubt about it. How could the Greeks have gotten so much right about the world, where we still have this legacy today of everything they gifted us? And yet, how could they have gotten wrong the biggest questions about life, the meaning of life, like why are we here and where we're going? To them, and not just at Eleusis, the Greeks absolutely found meaning, and they absolutely found a version of their god. You know, the guiding lights of Western civilization did not believe that Zeus was on a mountaintop hurling thunderbolts down at us half as humans. They were really, really sophisticated and very skeptical. So when they say they went to Eleusis to become gods, we have to pause and really think about that. Now, despite this identity crisis, I don't think they're mutually exclusive, which is why, of all things, controversial as it is, I look to psychedelics as the one thing that maybe both of these traditions had in common. So maybe the ancient Greeks used it at Eleusis and elsewhere, and maybe some of the earliest Christians, not the Last Supper, but the earliest Christians who would have looked to the stories they heard about Jesus as resonating with the kind of traditions of spiked wine that they'd inherited from their ancestors.
Now, how widespread would that experience have been? Particularly if it was something that was shrouded in such secrecy and which involved something of a pilgrimage from the sounds of it, how many people would have even known about such a thing and would have either experienced it themselves or known of it in a sense secondhand? Or is that a very difficult question to answer at this point, all these thousands of years later?
I think we have some information about Eleusis, and I mentioned that it survives, as far as we can tell, from 1500 BC to the 4th century AD. We do know that, at least in the classical period, so, you know, 5th, 4th centuries BC, Demeter's temple could have accommodated about 3,000 people at any one time for the proper and final initiation. So you take that number by the centuries and centuries that the mysteries were active, and you come up with millions of people. It's hard to say one way or the other. That's just back of the envelope math. But the only two conditions precedent to becoming an initiate were knowing how to speak some Greek, number one, and number two, not having committed murder. So it was a pretty low bar, but you did have to pay your dues to the hereditary families who ran Eleusis. So it wasn't necessarily for the lesser strata of society. But that said, I don't think it was that exclusive. And again, in addition to Eleusis, there were other mystery traditions, like the mysteries of Dionysus. And they were largely celebrated outdoors in the forests and mountains of ancient Greece and elsewhere, like southern Italy. And they were a bit more open. And so I can envision even more initiates flocking to that. In fact, so many in southern Italy in 186 BC that the Roman Senate decided to shut the whole thing down. And we have records of as many as 6,000 devotees of Dionysus being murdered in one fell swoop. So this stuff could get pretty out of control. And I think it was fairly widespread.
I want to make mention before we run out of time of a reference that you make to a very, very different book, which leapt out at me because I interviewed this author about this book, namely Jill Bull Taylor and her book My Stroke of Insight, in which she writes with remarkable clarity about what she experienced with a serious cerebral hemorrhage back in 1996. Explain to our listeners how her experience connects to these other experiences that you talk about in your book, The Immortality Key.
Right. So Jill Bolte Taylor, it's funny you mentioned that. Wow. I remember watching her, her TED Talk on YouTube at around the same time in 2007 when I was reading these very first studies out of Johns Hopkins. Hers was a non-drug-induced near-death experience. She had a stroke. And as she was experiencing this stroke, the very strange things started happening to her as she had this cerebral hemorrhage in her left hemisphere. It kind of went offline, and all she was left with, at least this is the way she describes it as a neuroanatomist, she calls it the deep inner peace circuitry of the right hemisphere. We think of the left and right hemispheres of the brain. Left is logic and reason. The right is this artistic, more free-flowing expression. And she uses this beautiful poetic language. This is a Harvard neuroanatomist talking about her near-death experience. She says that she felt like a great whale gliding through a sea of silent euphoria. And, you know, this mystical poetic language, it's very similar to what the volunteers at Hopkins and NYU say of their psilocybin experience, very similar to the mystical literature across the ages, from Judaism and Christianity to Islam, and even back to the ancient Greeks, very similar to what I quoted earlier from Plato and Cicero. So there's this really strange notion of these altered states of consciousness that introduce us to what all, you know, almost universally these people describe as a life-defining moment. Gordon Wasson, who was the co-author on that 1978 book, described his experience with psilocybin in similar terms, as if it was the realest thing he ever experienced. And the clinical psychologists have a term for this. They call it the noetic sense, the idea that you've tapped into a version of reality that is somehow more real than real. Now, if that happened to Jill Bolte Taylor in the early 21st century, and our neuroanatomy hasn't changed for a couple hundred thousand years, it stands to reason that the same experiences could have been happening not just 2,000 years ago, but tens of thousands of years ago, drugs or no drugs.
So do you have plans to dip your toe into this experience yourself? That's a rather personal question to ask, I guess, but I find myself prompted to ask it.
Well, I'm going to give you the lawyer answer. When it becomes legal, absolutely. I'm very interested in the experience. I'm more interested in curating and having conversations like this, and not just with you and your colleagues, but with the regulatory authorities in the U.S. and excuse me, in the U.S. and elsewhere. And also with religious institutions. You know, I consider myself a Christian, too. This is 13 years of Catholic school speaking, including 4 years learning Latin and Greek with the Jesuits. I think an experience like this, a once-in-a-lifetime, very carefully planned experience, very much fits inside traditional faith. It very much fits outside traditional faith. But this could be the kind of thing that could really propel someone even deeper into the mystical core of the faith they grew up with, like mine, for example, like Catholicism. So we don't know yet, but next year, these researchers at Hopkins and NYU are going to release a study of religious leaders who've gone through this experience with psilocybin. And it'll be very interesting to see what they say as they start talking about their experiences. Are these genuine mystical experiences that can actually enhance faith? Imagine what that would do for the world's 2.5 billion Christians.
Your book does raise the interesting specter of a new Reformation in which the religious experience of many, and not just of the Christian tradition, but other traditions, could be radically reshaped were this element to be sort of introduced into the mix of it. I do want to ask you about the fact that Johns Hopkins is undertaking such serious study of this. To what kind of a risk was it for Johns Hopkins to undertake a study that would take them into this particular realm?
That's a great question. I wonder how Roland would answer that. So I've talked a lot with Roland Griffith at Hopkins and also Bill Richards. And these were the two who really jump-started this latest iteration of the science, which, as you're probably aware, went on a great hiatus during the war on drugs. So Bill Richards himself, who's at Hopkins, was doing this kind of research in the 60s and 70s. And then because of the war on drugs, there's a hiatus in the 80s and 90s. And then together with Roland Griffiths, he brings it back online in the early 2000s. Government, you know, federal government approved, by the way. So I'm not sure what the initial reaction was, but I do know now. It's been almost 20 years in this latest revival of the psilocybin experiments. They have 50 peer-reviewed papers. Just last year, they had a donation to the tune of $17 million to create this new center for the active study of psychedelics and consciousness. And it's not just at Hopkins. I think Berkeley just launched a center, Imperial College London also last year. So it's one of these curious developments where only now, despite the fact that this new wave started 20 years ago, it's only now it's getting the right funding and the right attention. And I feel very fortunate to be able to talk about this research in a deeply scholarly and scientific setting, because I think the results are finally starting to get through both to government and the lay public.
The book, once again, is titled The Immortality Key, The Secret History of the Religion with No Name, an exploration of psychedelic experiences which may have occurred in ancient Greece and have perhaps been a part of the emergence of Western civilization in ways we might not have imagined. And the book chronicles the author's exploration of this and actually his travel to all kinds of places around the world, Greece, Germany, Spain, France, Italy, to get at the bottom of what, again, he likes to refer to as history's best kept secret. The book is published by St. Martin's Press. Brian Murărescu, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about your intriguing book, and best wishes to you.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. And now an interview from The Morning Show archives. It's not every day that I get to say that I am speaking today on The Morning Show with ABC's Dan Harris. And in fact, I feel very privileged to be able to say that for the second time, I am speaking with ABC's Dan Harris, co-anchor of ABC's Nightline and the weekend editions of Good Morning America, and a very, very highly regarded television journalist who also has generated some headlines because of the candid and open memoir that he has written called 10% Happier, which became a number one New York Times bestseller, in which he told his story of trying to come to terms with some mental and emotional demons. And it was through meditation, of all things, that he was able to really find himself into a healthier and more whole place. And he has written a new book, an audiobook called Meditation for Fidgety Skeptics, in which he delves further into meditation and what a difference it has made in his life. And I'm very honored indeed to be able to reconnect with Dan Harris to talk with him about his newest book. Dan Harris, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Great to be back. Thank you.
Especially for the sake of any listeners who missed our first conversation or for whatever reason don't know your full story, I think it's important for us to lay some groundwork here. Spell out, please, for our listeners, the kind of darkness that was behind what seemed like a very happy outward facade that the world was seeing.
Yeah, you laid it out beautifully, and I'll just elaborate on it. So I wrote a first book in 4 years ago called 10% Happier. That was kind of a memoir about how a skeptical, hard-charging newsman came to embrace something that he always thought was ridiculous, which was meditation. And the story there is that I had a panic attack on rather inconveniently on national television on Good Morning America back in 2004. I was reading the news headlines that morning. I was the guy who came on and did the quick wrap-up of the day's news. And in the middle of it, my heart started racing. My lungs seized up. My mouth dried up. My palms were sweating. I just couldn't talk anymore, and I had to quit and throw it back to the main host of the show. And that was very embarrassing. And even more embarrassing is what caused it. What caused it is that I spent many years in war zones as an ambitious young reporter and I came home from that experience and got depressed. This is after 9/11, and I did a very dumb thing, which is I started to self-medicate with recreational drugs, including cocaine. And even though my drug career was kind of short and rather intermittent, I was never using drugs when I was on the air or working or anything like that. After the panic attack, a doctor informed me that the drug use was enough to artificially alter my brain chemistry and make it more likely for me to freak out. And so that was a very humbling moment, and that's what set me off on the weird and windy journey that ultimately led to me embracing meditation. And what really changed my mind about the practice is that, there's a lot of science that suggests it's really good for you, that it can lower your blood pressure, boost your immune system, help with anxiety and depression, and literally rewire key parts of your brain. And so that allowed me to get started. And then a couple years later, after I wrote 10% Happier, I wrote a book more recently called Meditation for 50D Skeptics. And it's available as a regular book, but also as an audio book, which I recorded myself along with my co-author, who's a meditation teacher.
The title of the book, of course, implies that it is conceived especially for skeptics of meditation, and this is as good a time as any to add that you would be among the kings of skeptics, I mean, when it comes to meditation. Explain to our listeners just how unlikely a candidate for meditation you were, or in a sense, what an odd match it was for you and meditation to find one another.
It's a deeply odd match, no question about it. I'm a paid skeptic. You know, this is my job as a journalist. And I was raised by a pair of ex-hippies, and I grew up to hate everything that reeked of anything hippie-ish. So I was under the assumption that meditation was for people who live in a yurt and are really into Enya and collect crystals and that kind of thing. And what ultimately changed my mind, as I mentioned before, is one was the science. Again, that was very intriguing to me, especially as somebody who has suffered with anxiety and depression. That was very intriguing. And the other is that meditation does not involve, the other thing I learned that really got me to do it was that meditation doesn't involve a lot of the things I worried that it might. You know, you don't have to sit in a funny position. You don't have to believe in anything. You don't have to clear your mind magically or anything like that. That's impossible just to stop thinking. Meditation is simple, secular exercise for your brain. And let me just talk about the clear your mind thing for a second, because a lot of people, you know, suffer under this misconception that they can't meditate because they can't stop thinking. But the goal of meditation is not to stop thinking, because that's impossible. The goal of meditation is just to focus your mind just for a few nanoseconds at a time, usually on the feeling of your breath coming in and going out. So you sit in a reasonably quiet place, close your eyes, try to feel your breath coming in and going out. And as soon as you try to do this, your mind will go into full-on mutiny mode. You'll have all sorts of random thoughts. And the goal is just to notice when you become distracted and to start again and again and again. And that moment of noticing you become distracted is a victory. It's not a failure. It's a victory, because when you see how crazy you are, the craziness has less of a chance of owning you.
Hmm. Explain to our listeners how this book is put together by you and your co-author, Jeff Warren. It is something of a tour in which we are not only exploring meditation through your own eyes, but through the eyes of quite a few different people, quite a wide array of people, in fact, for whom it has really made a difference.
Yeah, the backstory behind the book is yet again me being dumb. I kind of unwisely assumed, you know, when I wrote 10% Happier 4 years ago, when I published it 4 years ago, I didn't know if anybody was going to read it, but I did kind of assume that anybody who did read it would magically hurl themselves into the lotus position and start becoming a meditator. That is pretty dumb, because it was way underestimates how difficult it is to establish a healthy habit. We're not good, you know, we were not wired by evolution to create healthy habits. Evolution didn't really care about your long-term health. It just cared about getting your DNA into the next generation. So we're really good. We have racing minds that are really good at spotting threats and spotting sources of pleasure like food and mates. But evolution doesn't really care about flossing, for example. So, you know, creating healthy habits is hard. And so what I decided to do with this book is to do a cross-country road trip in a big, silly orange bus with 10% Happier decals on the side. I recruited an amazing meditation teacher named Jeff Warren, who's actually Canadian, but we can forgive him for that. And I'm kidding. I love Canadians. Jeff and I went across this country, the United States, and we met all sorts of people, like social workers and celebrities and cops and politicians, all sorts of people who are interested in meditation but aren't doing it. And we helped them. We identified the primary obstacles, and we systematically tackled them and helped people get over the hump. One of the big obstacles is, you know, I can't clear my mind. We've talked about that. Another big obstacle is, you know, I don't have time for this. So we, you know, there are others like, you know, this is going to make me soft in my career, or people are going to think I'm weird, or somehow this is self-indulgent. And we, one by one, we go through them and we help you get over them.
Right. It's interesting because I think you're saying a couple of different things. One of them is that we have to sort of break ourselves loose of our preconceptions about what meditation is and the kind of person who is likely to enjoy it and or benefit from it. But the other thing is that meditation itself is in a sense a much more adaptable kind of thing. It isn't just one thing, one kind of practice that everybody has to figure out a way to do the same way. But in fact, it can, in a sense, fit just about anybody and just about anybody's life circumstances.
Yeah, Jeff Warren, my co-author on this book, I refer to him often as the meditation MacGyver, because he is really good at coming up with ways to meditate that fit you. And so one of the things he does is really help you turn everyday activities like brushing your teeth, walking between meetings, putting your kid to bed, and especially that's been very useful for my wife because we have a toddler and she's usually on putting the kid to bed duty. And so he helps you turn all of these often in-between moments into brain exercise that can ripple out into the rest of your life and make you calmer and easier to live with.
In fact, you're touching on an interesting fact here, which is that for some people, at least, they probably already engage in some meditation or almost are and just don't realize it. And that in many cases, this is not about carving out time to do something you've never done before, but maybe just doing some of the things you're already doing in just a slightly different way. So it can become, in a sense, a more meditative activity.
That is exactly right. Look, I think let me just add on, let me build on that, which is to say that we're always training our brains. Everything you do trains your brain in some way, you know? Like, so if you spend a lot of time sending hatred towards some political figure you don't like, or some, you know, neighbor you don't like, then your brain's going to get better at hating. While I don't recommend hating, this does to a very positive thing, which is that the brain and the mind are trainable, that we think we are a certain way. We have a certain level of happiness. We have a certain level of generosity, calm, patience. And that's the way we always are. These are factory settings that can't be tinkered with. But in fact, happiness, generosity, compassion, all the mental states that we want, these are skills that are trainable. And meditation is one of the ways to train these important skills.
Hmm. The book, again, is called Meditation for Fidgety Skeptics, and it is by ABC's Dan Harris, co-authored by a meditation teacher, Jeff Warren. The book is published by Spiegel & Grau, and again, it is available not only in print, but also in an audiobook recorded by Dan Harris himself. Dan Harris, thank you so much for this newest book and for all that you are doing to help people, and we wish you the very, very best in all that is ahead for you, and thanks for being part of The Morning Show once again.
Yeah, thank you for having me back on, and thank you for your wonderful questions. I appreciate it.
Next week on The Morning Show, some interesting interviews, including one with Laura Gelat, one of my all-time favorite morning show guests over the years when she was on the faculty at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. She has written a new book called Helen Perry Curtis and the European Trip of a Lifetime, and we'll be speaking with her about that early next week. Also next week, we will have Nan Calvert and her monthly visit to the program, and she'll be speaking with Willie Caratis, who is with the Rails to Trails Conservancy and the Root of the Badger Project manager. Also next week, the author of Dalco, the untold story of baseball's fastest pitcher. The morning show airs every weekday.